My name is Neil Hegarty. I'm a program director of the Flint Area Program at the Charles Stewart Mott Foundation. I want to welcome you to this session on land use and physical transformation. Anybody that spent time in auto communities, the kind of communities we've been talking about all morning, certainly knows how central land and land policy is to the issues that these communities are facing. The legacy of the old industrial sites, the manufacturing sites that sit vacant, the swaths of vacant and abandoned housing stock and commercial stock from the population decline are certainly some of the key issues that these communities have to face. Our goal with this session is to focus on some of these issues, to hear lessons and observations that have broad application across a wide range of auto communities. We're going to hear about strategies to promote economic transformation and job creation by dealing with these land issues. We've got a great panel to discuss this, and this is an issue that the Mott Foundation knows a little bit about the strategies and the complexity of this issue. Even though we're an international grant-making foundation, we have a large and vigorous grant-making in our home community of Flint, Michigan. On a typical year, we usually grant about $20 million, roughly $20 or $25 million in our home community. Last year, we put about $45 million in grants into Flint and Genesee County, because of the high need the community's facing and because of some unique opportunities that the community had. While we invest in a broad range of quality of life, economic transformation, and education issues, we've also invested heavily in land and land policy issues. We funded planning, development, implementation, and dissemination of a land bank model that we think is pretty darn good that Dan Kildee on the podium was involved with. And as Luis Urbinas mentioned this morning, the Center for Community Progress is something that the Mott Foundation and the Ford Foundation were co-lead funders on helping to launch, based in Flint with a Washington office and a national scope, trying to help communities all across the country deal with some of these land issues. This panel, I'm going to introduce the panelists in a moment, and we're going to have two 10-minute presentations, one with a Flint perspective, one with a Youngstown perspective. Then we're going to hear a range of responses and observations from our panelists, and then we're going to turn it over to you for questions, comments, observations from the audience. We're going to hear from Bill D'Avignon from the mayor's office. He's director of the Community Development Agency for the city of Youngstown. His mayor would have been here, but President Obama decided today to make a trip to Youngstown, so we're very happy to have Bill stand in on short notice in place of his mayor. We're going to hear from Dan Kildee, former Genesee County Treasurer and now the CEO of the Center for Community Progress. We're going to hear, they'll be doing two 10-minute presentations. Then we'll hear responses from Marvin Hayes, the Director of the Office of Urban Development and Infrastructure for the State of Ohio. We're missing Ron Sims, Honorable Ron Sims, Deputy Secretary of HUD. So hopefully he'll be joining us, but I haven't heard yet if he'll be here, but he was on the agenda. Honorable Maddie Stanislaus, the Assistant Administrator of the United States Environmental Protection Agency. The Honorable Marvin Hayes, I'm sorry, the Honorable Cedric Glover, the Mayor of Shreveport, Louisiana. And Jim Jacoby, Chairman and CEO of Jacoby Development with a private sector perspective. And to start us off, we'll hear from Bill D'Avignon from Youngstown.
Thank you, Neil. I'm going to start out with just a brief kind of history of Youngstown, go into the Youngstown 2010 planning process, kind of how we're implementing that, what we're doing, and some of the lessons that we've learned. I guess, how many people have heard of Youngstown 2010? Yeah, it's amazing. It's almost as if we had like a political or some sort of public relations campaign out there. But really what it is it's something that kind of has struck a lot of other communities, and they're kind of looking to what we're doing as for some answers. Hopefully I can kind of give a little bit of guidance as to, okay, exactly. The history of Youngstown. Youngstown was once a prosperous steel town. It had a population of 170,000 people, and we'd planned on growing. We planned and laid the city out for about 250,000 people. And we had one of the highest quality of life, highest per capita income in the nation. But the signs of that one industry, steel, started to show signs of weaknesses in the late 60s. And then again, you had some suburban depopulation or suburbanization that's kind of drawn away from the population of the city. And on September 19th, 1977, a day known as Black Monday, in Youngstown, the U.S. Steel closed, and in a few-year period, 40,000 people lost their jobs. The effects of that over this past 30 years is half the population of the city is gone, 57%. We have over 4,500 vacant structures, over 23,000 vacant lots or unproductive land, and we have one of the highest poverty rates and highest unemployment rates in the nation, and one of the most affordable housing in the nation. This is what that looks like graphically. On the screen, green represents vacant land. White is land that is occupied. And then every other color, from red to yellow, represents a vacant structure, and red being the worst. So we have from red to yellow being vacant structures in varying conditions. It's almost as if what you would notice or what you would see in the Gulf Coast area after Katrina, but it took 30 years for it to occur in Youngstown. We needed a new beginning. We were actually the beneficiary of something that was funded by the Mott Foundation. They commissioned the Harwood Group to do a study on Flint, Michigan, and they used Youngstown as a peer city. So the results of that was that Youngstown was a community in waiting. We were waiting for somebody to come save us. We were waiting for something to come and save us. And that never happened. So the community kind of had to take this on itself. In 2000, we started the process of the Youngstown 2010 plan, received unprecedented public participation. We had over 1,600 people fill an auditorium not once but twice during the process. And it quickly became kind of more than just a plan. It kind of became, within the community, a movement. And it articulates a vision and goals for a new Youngstown. Okay, and the plan was officially adopted in 2005. Those principles or the goals that were articulated throughout the community was one that, you know, we're not the Youngstown we used to be. We're never going to be that Youngstown, and we need to accept that. We need to accept that we're going to be a smaller city. Another platform that came out of that public process was that we need to align ourselves with the new regional economy. And the third platform was we needed to improve the image of Youngstown and the quality of life within Youngstown. And then a call to action that this needed to be a plan and a process that had specific goals, specific objectives that we could achieve and achieve by 2010. This is what we were faced with as far as the existing land use within the city of Youngstown when we undertook this plan. You know, a lot of industrial land that was kind of geared around heavy industrial, which was the making of steel, which we kind of came to the conclusion that steel was not going to come back, and therefore we would not need that type of industrial land, but we needed to rethink what that use would be. We also had an excess amount of residential land and more commercial than was sustainable within the city of Youngstown. So through developing the plan, this is what we came up with, which was changing that heavy industrial to a more industrial green, an industrial use that was geared towards light manufacturing, distribution-type uses, and shrink the amount of commercial that we needed and prioritize those commercial areas in areas that were sustainable, and, of course, kind of less residential and more green space. That's the premise of the plan. As I said before, this kind of became more than a plan, and it kind of became in a movement. And out of the Klan, new leadership emerged in the way of Mary J. Williams. And it also has received this national and international recognition. I mean, I can't tell you how many people are looking at Youngstown and the Youngstown 2010 Plan, what we're doing, from the Japanese, the Germans, and a lot of other cities in the other states and within the older auto communities as well. And it has allowed us, Youngstown, to project a new image to the world. We've also been able to sustain that community engagement. People are staying involved, and it's led to the development of additional plans and neighborhood plans and a vacant lot or vacant property strategy. We brought the National Vacant Property Campaign in, and they helped us kind of identify what our needs were locally and within the region. And it's also kind of as a direct result of not only starting this community back on the right track, but in getting people engaged. But we've also seen foundations, the Raymond John Wien Foundation, kind of turn its focus into the region. So they're supporting projects locally within the city of Youngstown and within the Warren. Namely, they've provided funding, sole funding, for the Mahoning Valley Organizing Collaborative. The Mahoning Valley Organizing Collaborative is, it was created to support the and identify leaders within the community to get them engaged and to help build capacity within the region. They've also, with a partnership of the city, one of the things we were lacking was this development capacity, CDC. So we partnered and created the Youngstown Neighborhood Development Corporation, which is a high-capacity, multifaceted community development corporation, again, filling a need within the community. Implementing the Youngstown 2010 Plan, I got a lot of what we're doing is geared on focusing strategies into certain areas. So, and it's as much about where you make, not just as much about where you make the investment, but where you don't make the investment as well. And it's also about reusing vacant property for economic development and to the reuse of vacant property for stabilizing neighborhoods and creating new open space. Under economic development, we've been very aggressive, and thanks to the state of Ohio, in creating business development opportunities, creating jobs. We have a Youngstown Initiative, which is an economic development program that we implemented in the city of Youngstown and has received recognition from the Small Business Administration. We're actually running out of brownfields in the city of Youngstown, which is a good problem, I guess. And we, again, keep these partnerships alive with the state, with the federal government, and also with Youngstown State University and our congressmen at the federal level. The brownfield strategy basically is to, the city is acquiring these properties, remediating them if necessary. We're going to provide the necessary infrastructure, water, sewer, roadways, and we sell that property as needed for a dollar and provide property tax abatements. Under the neighborhood vacant property strategies, we create the opportunity to create a greener city, but it also involves actually collecting a lot of data, and we've created a regional property information system. Also want to continue to keep that community engagement continued. We're targeting the removal of blight, developing neighborhood plans and strategies to reuse vacant property. One of the programs that we did is this Lots of Green program. Again, it was a partnership with the Youngstown Neighborhood Development Corporation. It's to target in one neighborhood to kind of prove that we can create a difference in making one neighborhood transformational and sustainable. All the different strategies that are involved there, including urban gardening, and creating economic opportunities within that neighborhood for the local residents to grow things and maintain the vacant lots. One of the other strategies is the creation of an urban wetlands mitigation bank. There's an area of the city, as I mentioned before, that was laid out and planned for development. It was platted off into parcels and paper streets put in. Again, that will probably never happen. And so the best use for this land, as we determined, was to try to create a wetlands mitigation bank. It's about 117 acres of land here, of which about 20 acres are currently wetlands. But all of the soils are capable of creating wetlands, so that was the idea. And again, these partnerships with the City of Youngstown, Youngstown State University, Mahoning Valley Organizing Collaborative, Mill Creek Metro Parks, Council of Governments, Lean Forward Ohio, all are playing an important part in making these things happen, as well as the citizens themselves, getting them involved, keeping them in the loop, and keeping them involved in their neighborhood. And, you know, some of the results, the city has torn down over 2,500 vacant blighted structures. We remediated 7 brownfields, created over 4,000 jobs, a total of 394 acres. We've also, using the Clean Ohio Fund, preserved over 200 acres of new land that will be kept as parkland. We're in the process of creating a new model zoning code to help implement the Youngstown 2010 plan, and again, the Idora neighborhood. Some of the lessons that we've learned is, you know, accepting the realities of what you have and where you need to go, and that growth doesn't always mean great, and that we can be a great mid-sized city. Try to create an environment that's attractive for business, and to try to get that land under control or in land banking. You know, that whole idea of repositioning land for the economic and environmental opportunities, you know, you have to get control of that. We do have a land bank, and that vacant lots within neighborhoods can be used as an asset and under a comprehensive strategy. And always look for those opportunities that you can innovate. And most recently, our most recent success is the expansion of V&M Star Steel. That's the reason that Mayor Williams couldn't be here. It's where the president was today. It's a $650 million project, expanding an existing steel mill, creating over 350 jobs. And again, you know, it was a lot of work, a lot of partnerships. It took 2 cities, the city of Youngstown and Girard, 2 counties, Mahoning County and Trumbull County. It took the state of Ohio's commitment, and it took federal stimulus monies to bring this project in. So we're glad to have the president in Youngstown, Ohio, to celebrate the success. And we just keep moving along, keep plugging away. And thank you.
Thanks, Bill, and thanks again for standing in on short notice from Mayor Williams. We heard from Detroit earlier, and we heard from Youngstown now, the importance of planning, key ingredient to transitioning these communities. We're going to hear now from Dan Kildee a little bit more about the policy side, one of the other key things that needs to be focused on in these communities.
Thanks, Neil, and thank all of you for being here. I won't follow the same pattern that Bill did, largely because the story of Flint is very much like the story of Youngstown. The maps might look a little bit different, but the fact that we've gone through a similar kind of economic change, I think would show up if I went through and showed you the maps of the city of Flint. I'm going to focus a bit more on a specific policy fix that we have been working on in Flint for about 10 years, largely with the support of the Charles Stewart Mott Foundation initially, reforming Michigan's tax foreclosure law, coming up with a land bank concept, and now with the support of the Ford Foundation and now also the Cerna Foundation, expanding these ideas around the country. So I'm going to tell you first about this new organization. I was the county treasurer in Genesee County back in Flint for a long time. But I now help lead an organization called the Center for Community Progress. And really what we are is the next iteration of the National Vacant Properties Campaign and the Genesee Institute, which was an organization that I helped to start back in Flint. And our goal really is to try to take empty spaces and turn them into vibrant places, to try to reposition policy, the way communities invest in vacant property. It was really interesting in the context of this conversation to listen to Larry Summers this morning talking about the auto industry and particularly the assets of the auto industry and his concern, federal government's concern, about an approach of liquidation and abandonment, which is really an interesting couple of terms when you think about urban land in general, because the systems that our organization has been working on and the systems that we have been fighting to change in Michigan and all across the country around urban land essentially have been systems focused on liquidation and abandonment. Property was viewed for a long, long time, and in many places still is, as a disposable commodity. And in fact, the modest few dollars that communities can get by selling land for tax collection, either selling liens or selling the properties themselves, those few dollars have had a higher value to the systems that have been in place than the actual use of the property itself. So we had a liquidation model in Flint that we replaced, and it's the kind of system that is still in place throughout most of the country. Our organization, by the way, is based in Flint, and we have offices here in Washington. Our goal is to not be another Washington-based sort of think tank, but actually have some real experience and continue our work in Flint and also work in lots of places around the country. Our story in Flint is a lot like many of the older industrial cities throughout the U.S. Flint had a population in 1960 of 197,000 people. GM employment at one point in time was 79,000 people. That was the year that I graduated from high school. I was 4 when I graduated. So I was that part of that last wave that had a choice to go work in the factory and make as much money as my father and grandfather made or take another path. And I took the natural path and went into politics at a very young age. But this is a community that has gone through this enormous economic transformation and was built and designed for a different time and a different place. Our master plan that our mayor, Mayor Walling, is here, that he has to work under right now, and I know he's going to change this, but it's a master plan that was last updated. The new plan is the 1965 design of Flint. And it was a design that anticipated that that population of 200,000 would grow to about 250,000. So what we have, as is the case with many cities across the country, is a pair of shoes that are too big for our feet. We have a design that doesn't match the real population that we have. We have an aging workforce, an aging community, and we know that unless we build the place that is attractive to those young knowledge workers that we talked about earlier this morning, that we can do all the things that a community can do to try to attract jobs and to grow that entrepreneurial class, but unless we build the place that's interesting to that class, we're not going to be able to make that transformation. Part of the problem, I was the county treasurer. That wasn't the problem. Part of the problem was that as the treasurer, I was responsible for implementing this arcane tax collection system. And if I described it in any great detail, you'd all get your afternoon nap. So I won't do that. But suffice to say that what we had in Michigan and were replaced, unfortunately, is what in one form or another still exists across the country in most places. And again, it's this liquidation approach. We had a process where people stopped paying taxes on abandoned property, and the government would just sort of take its time on the notion that we want to preserve the rights of people to keep that property. 5, 6, 7 years would pass back home before an abandoned property would be transferred to new ownership. And very often, that new ownership was a transfer to the state government, the death penalty for a piece of property, right? And so we had this system that took a long time delivered unmarketable title to speculative purchasers in a way that simply liquidated our interest in property. You know, and you've heard me say, some of you have heard me say this, that system was the energy behind those goofy Sunday morning infomercials, right? You ever get up and watch those? Become a millionaire, buy a property, sell it for 10 times its value. Those systems were speculator opportunities. What we decided to do with the 1999 tax foreclosure reform is, just for an experiment, treat land as if it were real estate. And take title to these properties into a public entity, the county treasurer in our case, and repurpose the property and not place the collection of taxes, the modest few dollars that can be collected by liquidating interest in those properties, not place that interest as a higher interest over what happens to properties in neighborhoods where people live, what happens to their landscape. So the system that we develop gets property into our hands much more quickly, into a public authority, not hundreds of different speculative owners, eliminates the tax lien system, and allows us to simultaneously help people who are facing tax foreclosure or the loss of their property through some sort of a hardship by helping them, and more quickly get a hold of those abandoned properties that are really a part of this really negative condition in neighborhoods. We got control of the property and figured we needed more tools. These are very difficult properties to manage. It's hard work. You have to either have a dog or a loving family if you're going to get into this business, because you take a lot of criticism. And we do, even back home. There are people here in this room from Flint who understand what I'm saying. Not this mayor or the one before it, but the one before that had a routine of referring to me as Flint's biggest slumlord, because we took all this junk property. My daughter would say, well, I don't understand why they're saying that. I mean, that's the property you get. She would say, duh, of course you're going to own all that junk property. We were after that. So this system allowed us to gain control of this land, which we've done, and then created a set of really robust tools to repurpose the land in a way that does not force each property, each of these individual properties, to face the market all by itself, all on its own. Without going into a lot of detail, the system we developed is one that allows this public entity, this public authority, this land bank, to treat the entire inventory of land that comes through that process as a single economic unit. What does that do? It allows us to create some serious internal subsidy. Rather than making some lucky infomercial watching speculator rich by taking the 4 or 5% of the properties that come through that system and privatizing the profit side of our tax collection system while we socialize the loss, what we did is we created a self-contained economy around those properties. So the high-value properties in the stronger market areas of our community do help offset, in a couple of different ways, the costs that we bear for taking ownership of lots and lots of junk property that we then can use to try to repurpose that land. So I look at these numbers and it's just staggering to me, because I've been gone for a few months from this, and we just added another 2,300 properties. But 17% of the parcels of land have now come through this system. I mean, you imagine how quickly this process has been working in other places. The problem is, we've been creating systems in other communities where we have this high recidivism rate. I mean, in some communities, if you added it all up over the last 25 years, the government would have executed a private tax foreclosure on about 300% of the land, because the properties just go in and out. We've now been able to sort of put a stop to that. We do take title through this tax foreclosure and land bank process, take a deep breath, and try to figure out the use of the property. And as you can see, it's not all junk. It can be made to be something beautiful and good, like the empty house that turned into the best house on the block, or the downtown building, the one on the right that sat empty for 25 years, or the one on the left that sat empty for 37 years. These beautiful gems became symbols of failure, symbols of decline, reminders that we're not the community that we used to be. And just by simply adding another set of tools and treating this inventory of land as an asset, not as a few properties we can sell and the rest of them are just junk, we've been able to create something really interesting. Now, I'm supposed to answer a couple of quick questions. One, what's the state's role? State policy, for the most part, is really a big barrier, a big roadblock. Tax foreclosure systems, number one, are 19th century systems at best. Wouldn't you say, Frank Alexander, our law professor? He and I go back and forth about the law. He is an attorney, me as a defendant, normally. But the tax foreclosure systems, you don't need to learn how the old ones work. We do have to figure out how to make better systems. Everywhere we go, that's a major barrier because these properties we lose control of them by liquidating our interest in the most precious asset that we have in these communities, and that's the land. Second, we adopted a Land Bank Act, a very strong act in Michigan, which is now being replicated in lots of places across the country, Ohio most recently, and we're looking for some progress in New York and Pennsylvania very soon on this, to take the public authority of land ownership and organize it in a way that allows us to repurpose these properties much more effectively. That's what the land banks are intended to do. And then finally, we added a series of amendments to the Brownfield Redevelopment Financing Act in Michigan. Maddie, you'd be interested to see what we have done is we basically said that everything in a Michigan land bank inventory is brownfield eligible under Michigan law. So we are able to use some cross-subsidy. We have a really unique tax increment financing plan that has 3,600 scattered sites in 17 different jurisdictions, all funneling money into the neighborhoods where we otherwise couldn't really afford to make that kind of investment, to demolish thousands of abandoned properties using that tool, relying on a stronger real estate market. So what have we learned? I'm almost done. This is what we've learned in this experience and what we're really trying to convey to other folks. There are essentially four pieces. There's lots more than that, but four pieces that I'll mention to create effective land banks. One is to connect the land bank to the tax foreclosure inventory, to reform that system, because there's two things that come from it. Number one, there's title to property. Second, those systems have a lot of money moving through them. And so connecting part of the resources that come through the delinquent tax collection process with title gives communities great power. Second, to the extent possible, scale the activity around the most diverse real estate market for which political agreement can be formulated. In Michigan, we've done that at the county level. And it's because we are able then to connect strong and weak market areas, strong and weak market properties to create a functional, sustainable economic model that has that cross-subsidy, that transfer, or as our president, when he was a candidate, would say, redistribution. It's a very important principle here. Third, land banks have to be policy-driven in terms of the acquisition, management, and disposition of property. The public in general, particularly in the places where we do most of our work, are rightfully quite suspicious of government participation in the real estate market. Of course, government participates in it anyway, but in this case, it's an overt participation in acquisition and development. And so each of those transactions have to stand on their own and be ethical and be done in a transparent fashion. Then finally, strong community participation in the decision-making process, so that the folks who are in these neighborhoods, the mayor knows them well. He has more neighborhood meetings than any mayor I've ever seen. So you've met the public. How do you like them? Yeah, we'll talk. They like it. The folks in those communities may not agree with every decision that is made, but a critical validator of a public authority working in this sort of a venture is the ability to say that the public had a chance to have their say. And I think that's it. Now, what's next? We'll talk about what's next as we get into the discussion. Thank you all.
Thanks, Dan. We're going to turn now and hear comments from this expert panel that we have. We've heard about the role of planning. We've heard about the role of policy. I'd like to bring Mayor Glover in the conversation and talk about how Shreveport is being proactive in creating federal and state partnerships, another important ingredient to transitioning these auto communities.
Thank you, Neil. Let me first of all start by thanking the Obama administration as well as the Brookings Institution. And I think I have to also, as a founding member of the Mayor's Automotive Coalition, send a shout out to Matt and Bill and Keith and all of the fellow mayors who have been involved in stirring the waters towards trying to focus attention on the needs and challenges of automotive communities across the country. And I guess Shreveport represents an interesting perspective on that in that we are not Midwestern, we are Southern, and when you usually think of the South, you think of foreign automotive manufacturing, but we've been a part of the domestic automotive industry since the late 1970s. Our challenges, I guess, are a little neither fish nor fowl in this regard, but it certainly represents, as Neil stated, yet another opportunity for us in Shreveport to figure out how to pull together an effective local parish. We have parishes as opposed to counties. Another part of we have gumbo instead of soup, another thing unique about Louisiana. So local, parish, state, and federal partnerships to be able to address the challenge that we have. We have a plant that's some 2 million square feet with a space, a million that's assembly, another million that's stamping, an investment in the last 5 years of about $1.5 billion by the GM system. They used to make or were wrapping up the production of the Hummer line there, steel making a pickup truck that unfortunately doesn't sell very well called the Colorado and the Canyon. And all of that's intended to wrap up sometime around 2012. And we, like you've heard with regard to the folks in Youngstown and Flint, have been a part of planning for this day for quite some time. My administration is in the midst of doing with a firm, Goody Clancy, which I'm sure several of you all have heard of, the city's first master plan in over 50 years. We hit the 200,000 population back in the 1950s and had an expectation that we were headed for 400,000 or so. But we've been stuck at about 200,000 for the past 50 years. We are at this point looking to, I guess, replicate some of the previous partnerships that we put together in Shreveport in dealing with similar types of challenges. One I'll refer to specifically deals with our downtown area. We had a great need to improve the quality of our hotel space, our convention space, and had a significant brownfield problem right on the northern edge of downtown. We pulled together a coalition of local folks, state people, and also enlisted federal help, got a significant infusion of brownfield dollars, and turned an old industrial site into a 350,000 square foot convention center and a $45 million flagship Hilton Hotel. It was so popular at the national level, kind of a mixed bag at the local level. You can imagine your local hoteliers, their reaction when the city decides that it's going to get in the hotel business. But so popular at the national level that we won last year's Regional Phoenix Award and the National People's Choice Award at the EPA Brownfield Conference. We are looking to take that similar approach to addressing what we see not only as our challenge but our opportunity at GM Shreveport. One thing that also happens to be unique about our region is that we also sit at the heart of one of the, if not the largest, depository of natural gas shale in the world called the Haynesville Shale. And we happen to have an idea that we believe that Shreveport could end up being the epicenter for a transition in the fuel source for the domestic automotive industry. As most of you all know who've probably followed this, natural gas is about one-third the cost of gasoline. The air that's emitted from a natural gas CNG-powered engine is, especially if you're in California, the air that's emitted is actually cleaner than the air that's already there. And there are about 110,000 natural gas vehicles right now in the U.S. That's compared to over 4 million right now operating in places like Asia, a half million or so in Brazil. There are about 1,600 natural gas fuel stations, fast fuel stations in the U.S. We are hopeful that with a combination of the things that we're doing at the level, at the local level, the incentives that are being put in place at the state level, and hopefully a growing interest at the federal level, that we'll be able to put Shreveport at the very core of a process that will end up with NGVs becoming a much bigger and larger and significant presence here in the U.S. and worldwide.
Great. Thank you, Mayor. We've heard a lot about the role of government. I'd like to bring in our private sector and hear from Jim Jacoby from a developer perspective, the private sector on the role of transitioning communities, land, land policy, development.
Okay. Thank you. And thanks for inviting me today. I'm sort of an oxymoron, an optimistic developer. And our sort of claim to fame is Atlantic Station, where we took a steel mill, which was a good education for closed automotive plants, and redeveloped that into the largest brownfield in the country at that time. EPA is a strategic partner of ours with Project Excel. And we've so far built about 6 million square feet of retail, entertainment, 3,000 residential units. And we did a tax allocation district that up to $500 million. We've already funded $250 to put the first split system of sanitary and storm sewer and put all the parking and the roads in. And it's interesting because when we purchased the property, the taxes were $300,000 a year. And when we're finished, the taxes will be $100 million. So AIG is my partner, and, you know, they were a great partner at the time. They're still great people, but they're going through a little bit of transition right now. But so it's been it's led us into the opportunity. I know we're talking about auto communities today because we have a big commitment to the environment, talking about natural gas. We have the largest landfill in Georgia that we're taking the methane, cleaning it, compressing it, cooling it, and putting Atlanta Gas Light's line. So we're actually gas producers. We're also involved with plasma gasification, trying to come up with some ideas about getting rid of municipal solid waste and making a syngas and hopefully someday get rid of landfills. We purchased the Ford plant in Atlanta a couple of years ago. One of the thoughts was we were going to build electric vans, and Mr. Mullally said he didn't want any competition. So, but we love the real estate, so we ended up purchasing it anyway, and it's contiguous to the Atlanta airport. And the plans there are the Aerotropolis, which is related to the airport, where we would build a potential new corporate headquarters for Delta, a regional headquarters for the FAA, probably 600,000 square feet, parking for the new international terminal with solar covering of the parking. Will be the largest solar play in the southeastern United States, probably 10 megawatts. And we're going to show our utility companies that solar does work in the southeast after all. And other things that could relate to the airport, but it's really about international cargo and things like that. Moving from there, we put under contract recently the Ford plant in Norfolk, Virginia. We love the ideas of ports, airports, seaports, rail ports, and Norfolk basically has it all, has a deep water harbor, 50 foot deep that'll handle Panama Canal ships and so forth. And, you know, we're Southerners also, the two plants we have being, you know, Atlanta and Norfolk. And so the idea would be to create alternative energy manufacturing facilities, sort of a shopping center for alternative energy, be it wind power, solar, gasification, smart windows where you press a button and, you know, the tint would change and so forth, and try to create green jobs, try to import technology from overseas and create the green jobs here. And so if we even have to create our own companies, you know, we'll look at creating incubators. And in our Atlantic Station project, bringing in partners like Georgia Tech, Emory, Savannah College of Art and Design, Georgia State, and so forth, where we can create the incubators, bring these innovators in, and create the jobs for our automotive plants that we're looking at redeveloping. So we've done the two we purchased from Ford. We looked at another one in Newark, Delaware that we were very interested in, but the university said, you know, we're interested, so we deferred. But I think in the long run, we're going to be invited back to partner with them and really talk about an energy opportunity there. So we're really optimistic about the opportunities to, you know, look at redeveloping these plants that, let's face it, you know, a couple of years to permit a project, a couple of years to build it, 4 years, we can be up and operating in 6 months. All the infrastructure is there, you know, great skilled labor force. And so we're trying to help out with this idea about, you know, creating the green jobs. I think we have a great opportunity at this this time right now. We're running out of time. But if we can, you know, work together in partnerships with the universities, retraining electricians to becoming solar engineers, retraining auto workers and so forth, creating a technical school at our project in Atlanta, tying in with all the other universities to retrain workers. So, like I said, I'm optimistic, and, you know, thanks for having me here today.
Great. Thank you. Great comments. And it's interesting, the issue of environment sustainability came up, and I think we should continue on that thread and invite Maddie Stanislaus to talk about the role of sustainability and environmental issues from the EPA's perspective.
Sure. I guess I'll talk generally about, you know, from my background and actually Ron's background, how we've taken kind of our work at the local level and translated that into our programs and to with a real focus on economically distressed and disadvantaged communities. The first thing that I did is to clarify that our resources can be used for planning. From my perspective, you're not going to turn around a distressed community by just throwing money at individual properties. You know, the best characterized site in a distressed community is going to be the best characterized site in a distressed community. It's not going to lead to a redevelopment strategy. So the first thing that I did is clarify that our resources can be used for planning. And by planning, you know, what I mean is you really have to go outside the property boundary if you're really going to revitalize these communities, look at the surrounding conditions, look at the state of infrastructure, look at kind of impeding kinds of adjacent uses if you're really going to develop a redevelopment strategy that enables the private sector to come to the table. At the end of the day, the public dollars can only go so far, and if you're not looking at public dollars as a vehicle for private sector leveraging, we're really not going to turn around these properties at an at-scale way, particularly in these large numbers of properties in distressed communities. So a solicitation that hit the streets, I'm trying to remember, David, about 6 weeks ago or so, calls for an area-wide planning solicitation. What enables is some direct dollars to conduct a number of various kinds of assistance as defined by the community. If the community decides that it wants an infrastructure analysis, they'll be able to do it. If they want to do market studies, they'll be able to do it. If they want to do end-use studies, they'll be able to do it. It's kind of tailor-made end-use strategies and area-wide strategies to look at both the reuse of the individual properties and the surrounding kind of investment that's necessary. Critically linked to that is the role of public investment. I think Ron probably says it better than I do, is we have to make sure our public dollars don't get in the way, first of all, and acknowledge that there's been a history of various agencies investing in a disparate way that's been counterproductive. So one of the things we want to do in this area-wide planning is identify how implementation resources can be identified in this area-wide planning process so that housing dollars and transportation dollars and cleanup dollars are linked and identified up front to actually implement the plan. Now, what a foreign concept. And the federal government actually identifying implementation resources in the plan. And we're going to challenge ourselves. It's not going to be easier, to be blunt. You know, we have programs that are built around a program culture, kind of defend the program culture. you know, trying to break that down to say we want the program to get along and be targeted at a community-based level is not going to be easy, but that's something I'm going to do. And I know that's Ron and his boss are going to do, and Ray LaHood, among others, are really trying to really focus on implementation resource that is linked to advanced revitalization. And in the way, you know, we will get sustainability. You know, and I truly believe that it is plan and ensuring the resources are done in a way that is based on planning. And a lot of times we've had, in my view, why there's an unsustainable practices is you've had disparate kind. You have transportation resources being placed in a certain part of the community, different from environmental kind of infrastructure, and that is the kind of the essence of unsustainable kinds of practices. The second thing I'm going to do is we're targeting dollars. You know, in the 2011 president's budget, we've identified $38 million in brownfield resources targeted to economically distressed and disadvantaged communities. And generally, what we're calling for in the solicitation is those communities that are distressed, we want to target those, both cleanup grants, site assessment grants, and kind of planning kind of resources. I mean, related to that, you know, the sustainability partnership that Ron is going to talk more about is we have a number of sustainability pilots that, and what we hope to do is not only provide direct resources to advance sustainability and development in that, but have it result in programmatic change. I mean, frankly, if we're only going to result in sustainability and redevelopment in six communities, it's just six communities. If the federal government is not learning the lesson of how do we need to change our programs to better direct resources to revitalize and redevelop communities, you know, frankly, we're not going to achieve sustainability. The other thing I will say is, you know, I don't believe sustainability happens to the federal government. No. I believe sustainability only happens by federal government working with the local partnerships. It only happens at the local partnership level. You know, what is sustainable for one community may be different for another community. You know, so it's not up to the federal government to dictate what is or is not sustainability. We want to provide tools to facilitate your analysis to define what kind of end uses and provide some best practices of adapting best kind of practices. I guess the last thing I will say is we're really kind of aggressively pushing job training. I think that if the local communities don't get a benefit of the redevelopment, we're not doing our job. So, I mean, beyond, you know, the EPA has a brownfield training program. Department of Labor has a worker training program. A couple of agencies have worker training programs. What we're trying to do is really kind of take it to the next level, trying to connect job training to actual job hiring. So, you know, I am personally looking at how the cleanup activities, for example, the auto communities, as well as the federal government contract, we can kind of connect the cycle of graduates with those that are graduated from the worker training programs that we have. And we're going to try to bring to bear some of the existing grantees that we've provide resources around the country to train for folks in these auto communities to be hired and participate both in the cleanup as well as some of the jobs that are created in that. Some of the curriculum that, even though it's called the Brownfield Job Training Program, has gone far beyond just cleanup. A lot of the curriculum includes, for example, photovoltaic installation, ecological restoration, and those kinds of activities. They're fairly broad-based kinds of activities, though. So with that, I'll kind of take any questions.
Thank you. Well, let's finish on the panel respondents, then we'll go to audience questions in about 10 minutes. This issue of partnerships has been brought up. Deputy Secretary Sims, I'm wondering if you could follow up on this partnership issue from the HUD's perspective and maybe talk about some of the characteristics of effective partnerships.
It's interesting. The issue of partnerships has been a huge cultural change and shock for the federal government and HUD and the agencies involved. Prior to being a deputy secretary at HUD, I was the King County executive, and we used to long for the time the federal government would talk to itself. And so that's exactly what's occurred. And here's, I think, what it was first when Secretary Donovan, Administrator Jackson, and Secretary LaHood made a decision that our functions could no longer stand alone. So we had what we call the external silos. You know, I've always said that clean air, dirty air, does not respect city or county lines. Never has, never will. It just blows where it blows. The same way with dirty water. And our key was to say we needed to think far differently about how we would approach issues. And so HUD used to, I would say, build housing or finance housing, but USDOT never coordinated. So sometimes we would have collision courses. Sometimes we would not have agreement, at least when I was at the county executive. And so we used to not want them to come in and disturb our peace. But we were able to work out, I think, an excellent agreement that simply says that our interests are the same. That whether you're a city that's growing, whether you're a city that's going to remain the same population, or whether you're going to be a city that's losing population or going through transformation, that whether you're urban or rural, the key is to have the policies of EPA and Housing Urban Development and USDOT actually harmonized in all those scenarios. It also entails new partnerships, those that we're working out with U.S. Department of Agriculture, those with the Department of Education. We have choice neighborhoods. They have promise neighborhoods. We realize that strong schools are really important neighborhoods. We shouldn't fund a choice neighborhood and then have a disastrous school system. We would have a choice neighborhood with a strong school system, which entails Department of Education. We talk about green jobs. It requires us to work with the Department of Labor. To end homelessness, it required us to talk about services to people. Because we realize that you end homelessness by ending the individual's homelessness, which is both services and employment opportunities. So HUD has moved, quite frankly, because of these agreements, from a housing agency that it was comfortably ensconced in for a long period of time to a development agency, which is a radical adjustment in culture. But we're going through that very significantly, including delegation of authority down to the local level, because that's what we have to hear from. We have 80 offices, and our key was to hear from them, empower them to be able to make decisions, and be able to look at HUD's resources and work with HUD's resources and also integrate their efforts with those of USDOT and EPA so that we would develop sustainable communities no matter what the condition of the environment that we're dealing in. Because it's an efficient use of land, the smart use of land. Now, what are we confronted with? Statutes. Wow, we have a lot of statutes that govern our money. And so we are going through saying, here's where we would like to go, and here are the statutory changes we need to get there. The one example, I was listening to Dan when he was talking, and land banks. You know, land banks are great, but they can be really effective the minute they can control the property that is important to control. A lot of city plans are based upon, we're going to make investments in this corridor. But we can't, through FHA, easily transfer our property to a land bank unless it's buying it at market rate or something close to that. Because those are the premium properties, and Congress says, hold a second, we want you to get a better return. And the city say, no. Those are strategic properties to us that are going to affect our development, and we want to be able to control those, and land banks as an effective mechanism. So we're trying to work through very elaborately with a lot of attorney work, being able to get those properties into the hands that need them. With EPA, EPA had an incredible brownfields program, and HUD said we were not going to build our facilities on EPA's property when after they cleaned them up. So we had to come back, and Secretary Donovan and Administrator Jackson said, no, oh, that doesn't make any sense. If they've cleaned them up, why don't we build on them? So we work through a rule and policy changes to be able to do that. So what we are faced with literally is this huge sea change. It's traumatic to some, welcoming to people like me, but it requires us to get used to it. Well, you know, what Matthew didn't point out is that on their grants, we sit on those teams. So EPA and USDOT and HUD participate on everybody else's teams for notice of funding availability. And that's really key, because it wasn't just that we wanted to embody an agreement in a memorandum of understanding. And let me tell you why I don't want to rest on a memorandum of understanding. I had a meeting with USDA, and they said, we had a memorandum of understanding with HUD in 1994. And I said, well, okay, how long did it last? 1994. And our key is not to work off our MOA. Our issue is to fuse a culture into sustainability so that when Secretary Donovan says that all $44 billion of HUD's grants are going to implement sustainability, smart use of land, smart use of housing, integrated transportation systems, good environmental outcomes, good health outcomes, because we can predict health outcomes by the nature of your house or the neighborhood you live in, issues of public safety, where is green, where are trails, where are parks, and in our most recent discussion, where are the arts? Because we realize that arts are absolutely critical to the welfare of any community and its sense of community. So we're trying to integrate all of these at one time. So a sustainable initiative is driving, I think, a fairly significant change in how the federal government operates, as well as how our agencies are operating. Our goal is to inculcate it. I've told people that why be there? Somebody called me a 48-monther. I'll never forget. You're a 48-monther. And I say, yeah, it would be a lot of bodies between me and that 48 months. But nonetheless, this is a person that's part of our change agent. But it was true because administrations come and they go. But our issue is that what we have found to be very efficient and very rewarding is all the collaborative process. So we're inculcating that so it will last, as I always say, for the next 40 to 50 years, because that's the only way we're going to be competitive. So no matter what a city finds itself in, we're simply saying smart land use, integrated planning systems, integrated modes of transportation, integrated housing. There's a whole series of things that we want in the sustainability we believe allows us to compete effectively in the 21st century. And in closing, I'll close. I always use this example. I have a granddaughter who's perfect. But she has to make a decision when she is 37 and just got married. And I would say that because it used to be 30, but now 37. But when she decides that she wants to have a family, if she wants to decide to have a family, she's got to choose between whether or not she pays for her grandfather's transportation system that maybe can be ill-afforded because it was just an issue of sprawl. You know, a quarter out there that was easy to build, more expensive to maintain and replace. Or is she going to invest her tax monies in the things that like public education and universities, because it's going to be the intellectual capital that allows our society to remain competitive for the rest of this century? There's only so much money in that pot. The pie is only so big. And the real issue is, how are we going to distribute that? And so when we look at sustainability, we look at is an economic issue. The smart use of land, housing, and development will result in the capacity of future generations to invest in those things that allow them to be competitive in the 21st century. And that's what's at stake, and that's why we're moving to a sustainability initiative. Thank you.
Good. Thank you. The state has a role. Let's hear from Marvin from the state of Ohio about the state's role in productive land reuse.
Well, sitting after listening to all the speakers on the panel, I do kind of realize that sometimes working for the state kind of feels like you're the middle child. Because on the one hand, you have to listen to local communities and what they need, and they're kind of telling you, we need more resources, we need this, we need that, but we don't really have a strategy sometimes I do. And then you go to the federal government, and they are kind of saying, well, you have to do this, and you have to do that, but you can't do this, and you can't do that, and you have to work with these guys and not those guys. And then you have to reconcile those two conversations, and you're kind of like, okay, what now? I think this is a good time, actually, and fortunate for me, to be a state official, because there are these conversations that are going on. You have local communities that are developing strategies and have a real focus, not just on the need for resources, but how they're going to use the resources in a strategic way to get at a strategic goal. And you have federal partners who are talking in ways that they've, to my mind, have never talked before, talking about how things integrate together to create an outcome. There are lots of commonalities to point to, but the one I'll point to and highlight for the moment for us in Ohio is kind of the imperative that drives all of our thinking and doing, which is, it's the economy. It is the economy, stupid, for real. Because if it doesn't produce a better, more economic productivity, if it doesn't produce more jobs, if it doesn't produce those kind of outcomes, then it's not really sustainable at the end of the day. And I say that because Ohio is in this, like most Midwestern or older industrial or auto communities, auto-dependent communities, is in a massive economic transition. The structure of our economy has been changing for some 30, 40 years. And quite frankly, certainly from the state side, policy hasn't kept up with the transition. We invest in ways that are not productive to the economy. We invest in ways that don't produce the kind of outcome or the kind of return on investment that is needed. Now, at the end of the day, what happens at the local level impacts us on the state. It determines whether we are sustainable or not. I can tell you that that Governor Strickland, who has been in office now for just over 3 years and going into his fourth, we've had to pare down our budget every year we've been in office. We look toward next year and we see more budget pain out there for us. So, the notion and the old adage of, well, you've got to do more with less. Well, you don't always get to do more with less. You get to do less with less. But you still got the imperatives of needing to grow. So that puts us in a position where we have to learn how to prioritize. And again, as I said, we have to stay focused on what, the real goal of any of our investments are. So in terms of, I kind of wrote down a couple of points in terms of, what can we provide from the state? What can we do? What are we supposed to be doing? The first thing I'd say is we need to be setting kind of a policy framework. And by that, I simply mean, and to reiterate the point, deciding what it is we, the state, are going to invest in. And part of that is an interactive conversation with local communities in terms of what they need, what they're prioritizing, and how they're investing. My job is in the governor's office, being in charge of urban development policy, is really a new one. It's never existed in a state government before. So when I first came into my position, my natural thought was that I would have people pounding down my door, kind of asking for this or asking for that. And quite frankly, that was not the case. And it kind of highlighted one of the reasons that Governor Strickland created the position in the first place. There was a disconnect, a real disconnect, between state policy and what happens at the local level. The locals just didn't come to the state anymore. They didn't think there was anything there for them. And that's a real problem, again, because that creates misalignments in terms of policy. It doesn't give us the opportunity to create a framework for what kind of investments are needed. And you have to have that coordination, especially in the context of having to take on the Herculean task of assisting the restructuring and realigning of your economy. So that leads me to kind of the points of alignment. Much as Deputy Secretary Sims was pointing out, at the state level, we need to do the same thing that's going on at the federal level. Why is it that our transportation investments never talk to our housing investments? So we build housing in one place, and we build a new highway interchange, or God forbid, we invest in transit in one place, and then we don't make the connection. That doesn't produce livability, and I'll kind of reemphasize. I'm going to keep saying kind of the same things, but the governor told me to. That doesn't get to sustainability, and when I say sustainability in Ohio, I mean economic sustainability. That's primary for us. Now, it's so primary that the governor, some 2.5 years ago, sat before the cabinet and said, I don't care what your job is in this cabinet, your job is economic development. That's our lifeblood. That's what we live and die on. And quite frankly, I mean, if you kind of look at the budget situation, that literally is what we live and die on. That determines, and there was a gentleman who was from one of the universities, one of the university systems, in one of the other sessions, and he was talking about, with some trepidation, talking about, the imperative of investing in education, and looking forward, he was expressing some real concern about what's going to happen to the university system's education budget going forward. Are they going to be able to? Are they going to have to make dramatic cuts? Are they going to, lose the ability to provide some services and not be as competitive as they want to be? That's what's at stake in terms of the coordination and ultimately the economy. There is the effect, the way the economy seems to work, that there are downward spirals and there are upward spirals. And once you get in a downward spiral, it's very difficult to get out of. I mean, once you're not making as much money, you're having to cut, you're not investing, you're not getting quality of life and quality outcomes, and you have to cut again. So again, the talking through alignment, infrastructure development, economic development, community development, all of these things have to be aligned in ways. And this all happens in a context of limited resources. So the other side of alignment is prioritizing, which is something that is extremely politically difficult, be it at the state level or be it at the local level. But, I mean, it is basically a reality of life that we can't invest in everything at the same time. I tell people in sidebar conversations, I'm from Cleveland, so I kind of bring the Cleveland perspective to state government policy. I tell people all the time, and I think it's a very fair statement, the city of Cleveland did not attain the condition it's currently in overnight or over the last 10 years. It's been decades that this condition has been developing. It's going to be decades before we realize some wholesale change. That means that we're going to have to make decisions and choices on areas of the city where we're going to invest. Now, as a state policy official, one of the difficulties of my job is I don't get to make those decisions. I'm never going to tell, or the governor's never going to tell any individual mayor where they should prioritize their resources. As one mayor kind of groused at me in a meeting once he said, okay, well, exactly which one of my children would you not like me to kill? Which I thought was a little harsh, but I understood his point. It's a difficult position to be in, and there's no power that I have. And quite frankly, based on the limited resources we have, there are no resources I have, not enough resources I have to incentivize them to get to go one way or the other. So it has to be kind of a cooperative alignment or a cooperative process, an alignment of vision in terms of how we're going to get from here to there. We have to, on the state level, promote consensus. Ohio is a big place. We have the second most metropolitan and urban communities in the country next to California, which means, in a kind of a crass way of putting it, we have a lot of mouths to feed with state policy and with state resources. And you're not going to feed them all the same level at the same time. This politically speaking, there's a term that kind of flies around, which I'm sure you're all aware of. It's kind of the peanut butter approach. Just spread a little bit of resources across the environment, and everybody can't grouse because they all got a little bit. That's not a productive way to grow an economy, to transition an economy. It has been the paradigm that we've existed in for quite some time, but it's just leading us into demise, quite frankly. It's leading us into economic unsustainability, and it cannot go forward. But you don't get there if you don't get that kind of alignment between a local official who's making decisions and state policy officials and the governor who are helping to facilitate those decisions. So consensus building is going
to
be...
Let's transition to some questions now. If you want to make a final comment, and we'll go
to... The final comment I would say just very quickly is there's one element that I've come to learn from some local policy officials that I wouldn't have quite have made an emphasis on previous to this, but it's confidence. If I'm using a book I'm reading by Robert Shiller, I'm using his term, it's the animal spirits of economics. And confidence matters more than I've ever given it much regard for. It matters so much because, if let's say if you had a neighborhood and you had 100 homeowners who were willing to invest in that neighborhood and buy houses, you'd have one effect. But if you have only one homeowner who's willing to invest in a neighborhood of 100 houses, you have another effect. So there has to be a sense of confidence in the plan, in the vision going forward that is shared across the community in order for this to be productive. So confidence comes from our federal partners who say these are the resources we have to invest. Confidence comes from that alignment and that consensus building in terms of developing policy that creates a strategy going from here to there.
Great, thank you. Let's open it up for questions. We've heard a lot of great comments from federal, state, private sector, municipal level, and I'm sure there's a lot of questions. So I think there's a couple of mics are going to be in the audience. Please.
Well, I won't need it. I'm Steve Bancroft. I'm responsible for dealing with foreclosures in the city of Detroit. I have job security. And I suspect what we face in Detroit is not much different than what most of the other cities that constitute the group that are here are contemplating. We have 40,000 empty properties owned by the city, but in the last 3 years, 55,000 to 60 properties changed hands through the foreclosure process of the city, which means in the partnerships we're talking about here, there's a group that's been left out, whether it be Fannie Mae, Freddie Mac, MBSs, I don't care who it is, whatever banks or servicing agencies control a lot more of the property, or the reality of what we want to do with that property than any of the organizations that we have looked at today. And having dealt with them, I will tell you it's very complicated, very difficult. Bringing them into a partnership through some kind of process similar to what we've done today that would include them would be very helpful, I think. If you're getting out of silos at HUD, Fannie Mae hadn't discovered that yet. REO is a very different reality than mitigation, and I can go through the whole list. And they need to be brought into this, I think, and I hope there's going to be some movement past this moment for that kind of production.
Over to Joe.
I guess my question deals with planning and the resources for planning. So, I mean, listening to the panel earlier today, we know with Detroit and Toni Griffith, I mean, you know, an amazing planner. She's got an amazing challenge ahead of her. Of course, she is being funded through philanthropy. So then I look at Bill Davignon in Youngstown. I know Flint hasn't had a planning department for years. So where are the resources for planning? I know with the sustainable communities, they're looking at regional planning. EPA has got the area-wide planning grants, but those are competitive. So for some of these communities, they don't even have the capacity to apply for, you know, really a competitive planning grant. So I don't know whether it's from the state or local government philanthropy, but it seems if we want to have sustainable communities or break down silos at the state government level or federal government level or do the really hard lifting that's going to happen in Detroit or Flint or Youngstown on the physical plan, there needs to be more planning capacity. So where do we find that, particularly in tough economic times?
I can. The HUD is using a variety of funds to provide what we call technical assistance, which is paying for the planners. We realize that in this environment, a lot of people have already cut them, and so or reduce those staffs, and they're going to be unable to respond to our requests for planning information. So we have both through the sustainable grants and through our grants coming out of planning and community development are creating that very mechanism so that we can go out and say, here are the areas. And we have a Ralphio Bostic and Secretary Mercedes Marquez are both coordinating their efforts so that we can get the money to those places where we know because of the situation they're in have lost or need an additional capacity on the planning side, and we're going to fund that so people can compete. I believe EPA is doing the same thing on technical assistance. USDOT is doing the same thing. So we realize that planning is important. So when we talk about planning, we're simply saying there are some people who already have it. We'll work with them. There are some people who don't have it, and we'll give them the planning they need to be responsive.
Go ahead. I was going to say, if I could add on to the comment, I think right now from the state perspective, it's kind of creative, it's kind of creative thinking in terms of where to find planning dollars. I know our Department of Transportation has been pretty good about using some of their research dollars for planning activities for local communities, kind of stretching the definition of what those dollars were traditionally used for. So, but even more than I think there needs to be some real acknowledgement that of the importance of planning activities and how pivotal that is in terms of having kind of a way forward. I think that's probably the most important thing is, I mean, there right now there's kind of no real good place for local communities to go get that extra capacity. But I can tell you that there's still at some in some local communities in Ohio, there's not the understanding of how important the role planning plays. And so, quite frankly, I mean, those folks are the generators of the consensus that more of those resources need to be allocated for that kind of activity. The other thing I would say is from the state agency level is the importance of understanding different planning paradigms. Because right now, as far as I understand, our Department of Transportation, by example, plans pretty much just strictly on demographic shifts. So if population goes here, then you're going to need more capacity there, as opposed to planning a little more strategically, planning in a scenario. And I'm more and more an advocate of that, especially for communities that are shrinking in size, that are losing population and have infrastructure challenges. So those are the things I think I would articulate.
Well, I mean, the area-wide planning solicitation is designed to look at the nexus of the surrounding area and the large property or multiple of properties clustered together, and to look at what's the stuff that's necessary to be addressed to enable the redevelopment of that set of properties and infrastructure and all of that. I mean, it's not master planning, and clearly we have heard that that resource is necessary. But I thought it was a really interesting thing when Ed Montgomery and I went out to the Midwest, had a series of meetings with a bunch of mayors, and they basically said, don't give them grants. You know, they said, give us technical assistance. You know, to us to really move forward today, provide technical assistance. So we listened. So the area-wide planning is primarily technical assistance, and the communities can identify the nature of technical assistance. We also have the opportunity to help organize the local process as part of that, because I think that's critical as well. So that's currently how we structured it.
So. I'd like to add, if you don't
yeah,
mind.
Please do.
I think one of the things that you also have to be willing to do, and it may be kind of a chicken and egg scenario, and that is hopefully you have leadership that is willing to go out and cultivate an enlightened constituency within your community, because there are individuals within your respective cities who do have an understanding and an appreciation, especially if you are within a community like my own, which had not done a master plan since the early 1950s, that there has been an ongoing need for one, and there is certainly an imperative for one right now. And if you have an expectation that one of these fairy godmothers who I'm sitting up here with might show up with the resources to help make that happen, then you may be in for a rather long wait. You welcome them. It'd be nice to have them come along. But if it's going to happen, you commit yourself to making the hard local decisions that says, despite the fact that resources are sparse and few and far in between, we have to decide whether or not we truly understand whether or not this is something that's necessary in order for us to be able to take the steps forward that we want to take as a community. In Shreveport, that means that we have spent $1.2 million on our master planning process over the last 2 years at a point in time when last summer we shut down all 9 of our city swimming pools because we understand in the short term it'd be nice to swim. In the long term, it'd be better to have a coherent vision of where it is that we're trying to go as a city. And so it's also something that I think we have to accept responsibility for helping to make happen at the local level as well.
Of being fairy godmothers, given that you hopefully will have more than 30-some months to implement this larger sustainability agenda, fast forward, what do our metropolitan areas look like in 5 or 10 years from now? It's one thing to say it's not going to happen overnight. It's another thing to say it's an ongoing process. But what really is different about our communities, how people live, how they work, 5 or 8 or 10 or whatever the right timeline is from now, so that we can start to paint a vision, not just to the collaboration that this will take, but what will be different about our cities that help sell to, in my case, a set of constituents this vision of a more integrated, sustainable place? Be interested in some thoughts on that.
We don't have been pretty well focused on the Sustainable Communities Initiative, and as I said previously, I think we're developing consensus with our local partners that, you know, really is about economic sustainability. So I think from the vision that I've seen coming out of some of our local communities, I'll take the city of Cincinnati just as an example. It is investments, both state and local and federal investments, in the assets that don't currently exist that will make the community, create a more quality community, but also add into the economic productivity. And so you're making the place more attractive, but you're making the place function more efficiently in terms of what it produces. So just by example, in our three largest cities in Ohio, Cleveland, Columbus, and Cincinnati, all of those places have a core cluster of jobs. And that core cluster, much to Brookings framing, is from the Central Business District to the Meds and Eds Center. Each one of them have it. It's where the largest concentrations of jobs are, not just in those places, but in the entire state, and there are three of them. Only one of those has an actual transit node that goes from the Central Business District to the Meds and Eds facility. And further, none of them have good public transit, be it bus or light rail transit, from the outlying communities to those job centers. But we also know going forward that more and more people from the outlying communities are not working inside of those counties or in those local jurisdictions. They're migrating to work in different places, in many cases in these centers. So vision forward is public transit that connects clusters of residences to job clusters. And that, we believe, is a statement on quality of life, but also on economic development, because that will promote more investment not in those corridors at the same time as it's, you know, creating a better quality of life.
So I guess I have a three-part answer to that. Equity without compass sustainability, that's the first thing that should happen. I mean, the fact is that equity and sustainability have not gone together as a general rule, you know. So we don't look at sustainability and what is sustainable for low-income communities, what is sustainability for communities that are left behind, that have pollution burdens. I mean, the fact is there are at least two different societies out there. And so my hope is when the Obama administration finishes in 8 years, whatever the clock is, you know, that we will have begun moving that forward, you know, and I don't think we're anywhere close to that. The second thing, and I think Ron was saying, is, you know, hopefully that our programs are changed so that our funding formulas and DOT's funding formulas and HUD's funding formulas are interlinked and provides priority and preference to sustainability in the way that it does not exist today. That's going to require both statutory and regulatory changes. So those are two things I will say.
I think from HUD's perspective, here's what we probably see in the community. A little bit more density. We're going to see, first of all, we're going to want a plan. Trust me. We're just going to want to see a comprehensive plan that integrates all the elements of housing, transportation, community design, parks, arts, schools. We're just going to want to see that. And that's going to be really important to us. And see, on a metropolitan area, a narrative is how people are going to be disciplined enough to implement it. It's going to require local funds, philanthropic funds, if you have a philanthropic community, some places don't, the business community, as well as federal funds and state partnerships. So we're going to look and see, do you have a really comprehensive community plan that tells you where you're going? We're going to want to see efficient use of land, which means we're going to want to see a little bit more density. We're going to want to see parks because, remember I said earlier, we can predict health outcomes by zip codes and community design and how the neighborhood's designed. So we're going to want to see how over time will an established neighborhood change and how new neighborhoods will be created that will reflect better community design, tighter housing, and a relationship to transportation systems and employment. So that we have smart employment centers. So we're going to, I think in total, we're going to want to see a tighter community. And that entails a whole series of things. The equity is going to be very, very significant for us because we know that we can predict life outcomes by zip codes in any city in America. Long-term earnings of children, morbidity rates, what illnesses you'll actually die of.
rates of tooth decay. All of that's predicted by zip codes. So I think Matthew and I were talking about on the equity side is we believe in the end that if people did a plan that actually removed what we call the disparities that exist in the community, they would have a much different land use pattern, much different public transportation or transportation pattern, a better association of neighborhood to parks and really good schools. We want zip codes to be an address only, never again a life determinant. And that's why that's why sustainability and equity are so integrated.
The appeal for planning is a good place to wrap up. Unfortunately, we're out of time, and it brings us full circle to where we started, talking about planning and the role of planning in these communities. Before we thank our panelists, I want to remind you that we're returning to Regency A in 15 minutes for the congressional response. I want to thank all of you for joining us and thank all of you for the questions, and I especially want to thank all of our panelists for very informative and insightful thoughts on this. Thank you.